Look, I want to thank you for enduring all these years that I was an insufferable bore.
Sir, did you just have a surgical procedure?
What do you mean?
Well, was the stick successfully removed from your ass?
Hello and welcome back to The Letterboxd Show, our podcast about the movies people love watching from Letterboxd, the social network for people who love watching movies. I'm Slim. Gemma is also with us in studio, and this week we travel across an ocean to England to meet a guest whose day job is very much of interest to the Letterboxd crew right now, as we're making the final tweaks to a new poster feature that will allow patron members to select the poster when you look at your favorite film's Letterboxd page.
Jay Bennett is a poster designer with the creative agency Intermission Film, who do amazing work in the cinema space, creating posters and trailers and other things to get us to go to the movies at the cinema. Jay is also a Letterboxd member with more than 30,000 followers, 85 very specific lists, and a ratings histogram that holds right back on those 5 stars. We need to know more. So please welcome, to quote from his profile, the silliest little guy on Letterboxd, Jay. Hello and welcome to the Letterboxd Show.
Hi guys, thanks for having me on. This is really exciting. So yeah, I really appreciate you guys inviting me on here.
This histogram is blowing my mind. So the chart on everyone's like Letterboxd profile, when you look to see someone's rating spread, you know, through up to 5 stars, it's like, do you see this, Jay? Is this a bit? It's like the most perfect histogram I've ever seen. There's like no 5 stars. It's insane.
It's so good. Yeah, I'm glad someone's like finally noticed it, because I have been like keeping this up and people have like mentioned it every now and again of like why I hang back on 5 stars. And you guys like the first people to like bring it up verbally and in such a public platform as well.
like to describe it to the listener, it's like a really pretty staircase, steady, steady, beautiful, beautifully designed staircase up to a horrifically terrifying cliff. What does a film have to do to get a 5-star from you?
I don't know. I've always just had this thing that like a 5 stars is like the epitome of like perfection. It's got to be like the best film in the world. I've got to keep coming back to it. That's why I don't give a lot of films 5 stars like initially.
Mm. RoboCop, how many stars? 5 stars, surely.
I'll
tell you what, I'm looking at it right now. I don't see RoboCop in Jay's 5-star ratings.
Unfortunately not, no.
Paddington 2.
Paddington 2 is 4.5, I think. Ooh. 4.5. I don't know, I just have such like a thing about like, just like if I keep coming back to it, like over and over again, it's got to like mean a lot to me, and I've got to have so much like stories behind it for it to be like the absolute perfect movie. Although like, if you look at my 4 stars, like all of those are movies I can't really find like a fault with. So like realistically, those are the 5 stars. But the five stars is just like an extra bit, you know?
Okay, so what's got 5 stars?
There's one that jumps out at me real quick, Martyrs, 2008. This movie, yes. I've seen reviews of this movie, people just being totally horrified about it. It's like a revenge movie, but some depravity involved, but this one makes the list. 5 stars.
Yeah, it's just such like a morbid movie. It's such a bizarre one to give 5 stars, but like I think it was like the first really like horrible movie I watched that I felt like so much effect from. Like a horror movie that finally like, I feel like I have
made you feel pretty sick.
Exactly. Like I feel like I have pretty thick skin when it comes to horror movies, and this one finally like cracked through my like outer shell and just made me feel like disgusting. But it's just so well shot. It's like a perfect story with amazing performances. And I'm kind of shocked it doesn't have more of like a cult following.
As well as one of the most batshit insane histograms in Letterboxd history, you also have a lot of fun with Letterboxd lists, Jay. You identify quite specific themes and connections, such as Tom Hardy invents an accent, films ranked by the quality of the mac and cheese. Can you believe it? Good title. That's the list of the weirdest and worst films that premiered at Cannes, like Gotti, X-Men, The Last Stand. I have an issue with Dirty Dancing being a bad Cannes premiere, but we can find that out.
I was just surprised that showed there. It's not so much that like it was a good or bad. I was just like, wow, that was like a Cannes premiere. When you think it's like esteem and like the highest quality of like film and very, you know, they're very selective of what they choose there. And like Dirty Dancing was there. So, I mean, it's great. It's a great film.
That's what Khan would like us to think, but they showed Shrek and Shrek too. So, you
know. Of course. And deservedly.
Yeah. And then the epic one, which is kind of spoilery for those who don't know about these moments. Who let Matt Damon into the studio? A list of films where Matt Damon shows up unprompted when no one asked.
It's true. He shows up a lot. Like any movie, like four, you just don't expect him to pop up and it's like a jump scare.
I know. It's so weird. The first one I remember is Eurotrip. I remember I had that on like VHS when I was a kid. And like famously is in the band that sings the song. I wonder what it is with Matt Damon because he does have a thing for like,
he loves a cameo.
I'll appear for this. He does. He loves
and you cameo. Say that. And you say that and I haven't added that film to the list. So that's going straight on there afterwards. you're fueling my fire. It's going straight on there.
I think that during this show, we should be asking you not just to rate the films, the four favorites, but also the posters for those four favorites.
Of course. Sounds great.
Yeah. Do you, in terms of the lists you keep, are you about to make a favorite posters of all time list?
Honestly, like with this new feature coming along and the article that's following this, I think I have to.
Yeah.
There's so many great ones. I just need to like kind of hone in considering it's like my, you know, the thing I consider my like professional craft. I need to kind of go in into that on Letterboxd really, because I haven't really touched on it much other than the fact it's like in my bio.
One of the things that I started doing, so the Letterboxd crew has had access to like the, you know, patrons can change posters on their, you know, when they look up a movie or you make a list, you can have your own view of your posters that are appearing on TMDB and elsewhere.
Yeah.
I started looking at the Criterion posters at some of the movies that are available. I mean, they're so gorgeous. Why not throw them on there? You know,
exactly. No, you have to. That sometimes the Criterion covers are just like far more beautiful than the actual key art. Like, no slander, but like they just announced the Criterion's in a couple months and they feature Power of the Dog.
Oh yeah.
And that one is stunning, and like no shade on the agency that created the Power of the Dog key art, because it is also very pretty. However, that like that cover with the is, I think it's like the flowers are in his hand.
Oh yes. Mm-hmm.
It's gorgeous.
Yes.
Stunning artwork.
I just changed it.
You also have a list on your Letterboxd where you rank the Saw films based on how morally right the Jigsaw Killer is, which, of course, brings us to the first of your four Letterboxd faves, and we're going to discover where on that list of moral rightness the original 2004 Saw film sits. This is directed by James Wan, written by James with Lee Whannell, who plays Adam. It has a surprising 3.6 average. I would have thought higher. And you are one of 3,300 fans who have this in their four favourites on Letterboxd. Obsessed with teaching his victims the value of life, a deranged, sadistic serial killer abducts the morally wayward. Once captured, they must face impossible choices in a horrific game of survival. The victims must fight to win their lives back or die trying. And also, Danny Glover is in it. Let's get straight into it, Jay. He never calls for backup.
Oh, not at all. Absolutely. He's a man that just wants to capture himself. He is driven on revenge. He is... The bit later on in the film where like you find out the reveal that he's been like stalking the doctor's like, apartment the whole time.
He's been stalking the Dread Pirate Roberts Jr.
And you found out he's been stalking the whole time, and he's there like just doing his raspy voice talking to himself like, "I've got him, I've got you this time." it's just glorious. What a performance.
one of my favorite scenes is, you know, skip ahead maybe if you haven't seen Saw, but I think a lot of people have, but like when he finally like is having that fight in the hallway and it just like goes so south for him, I just like throw my hands up in the air like, come on, my
it's
god,
it's so funny. It's like he just constantly fails. He is easily one of the worst cop detectives in any of these like types of horror movies.
He is.
It's so funny.
So with, in terms of horror and Saw, what's your backstory with the genre, and do you remember when you first saw this movie? Was it in theaters?
No, the first Saw movie, to me, I got introduced it in a way. Essentially, I got introduced it from my dad, which, like, you wouldn't think the Saw movies growing up would be a film that your, like, father would introduce you to. However, we did do, like, the whole watching, like, Star Wars and Indiana Jones as a kid. Mm-hmm. Like, in movies you should be introduced to by your dad. But I don't know, I just got this weird, like, obsession as a kid. Like, your dad's constantly watching these movies in the living room where you're meant to be in bed, and you hear them downstairs, and every time I'm like, oh, can I come downstairs? He instantly turns them off. Like, I want to know more about what he's doing down there.
Was this one where he didn't shut it off? So you came in and he was like, all right, I guess you can watch this one.
Well, no, not really. So I come downstairs and he's watching the fourth one, and I catch a little bit of it. And I'm around like 13 or 14 at this time. And I go and like pirate it essentially on my laptop upstairs. And like, because, you know, I mean, why not? I haven't got access to a physical copy. Streaming isn't a thing yet. So I go and find it online upstairs. And it just sends me into this like deep spiral of like crime and horror movies. It leads me on a path towards like Seven and Silence of the Lambs, like all of these like twisted, like time jumping tales of trying to catch a killer and like diving inside their mind and seeing how it works. And I mean, then the story goes on from there. Then I just get obsessed with the rest of the movies, and it's a whole spiral downwards. Mm-hmm.
This was 2004. Another film that came out in 2004 was Shaun of the Dead. It was a really interesting year for horror being remade and kind of reconstituted from all of its, you know, various grisly parts by young non-American, you know, sort of bright-eyed writer directors who had grown up like you with the genre and gone, I'm going to put my stamp on it. I mean, this has spawned, you know, an absolute empire of horror films for both James and Lee.
No, absolutely. I feel like what also like got me so interested in film from this is reading all of like the IMDb trivia stuff, and you find out that the film cost around like $700,000, and there's just these two like Australian students that managed to get their script across the world over to the States and shopping it out to production companies, and they made this film for $700,000, and it made around like $150 million.
My God! So $700,000 basically buys you Danny and the catering. And everyone else is in there. I mean, Cary Elwes at that point had been pretty quiet in terms of his career. This is a real revival for him after the Princess Bride days, right?
Yeah, definitely. It's just like so amazing how they had like this small amount of money and this small turnaround of like 17 days and got all these like stars there. And it's such like a skeleton shoot of like a tiny crew, all in this one little like rundown bathroom set that they've had to rebuild like over and over again. It's absolutely disgusting.
Yeah, I was talking to Gemma before, and I didn't realize that Lee, you know, the co-writer and in the movie, I didn't realize that Lee was also the director of Invisible Man and Upgrade, which has a huge cult following that had come out a few years ago. So, I mean, because when I was watching this, I was like, why haven't I seen this young guy again? Mm-hmm. Well, he went on to go direct some pretty popular movies.
Yeah, because he's a far better writer and director than actor, as the film shows.
I mean, you said it. You said it, not me.
Funny that you should both say that, because I didn't remember Adam at all. I know I saw this at the movies when it came out, but all I remember is Cary Elwes in the two-way mirror and the dead guy in the room. I'm sorry, was I drunk? Maybe I was drunk in 2004. I don't know, but I'm really sorry, Adam. But what's really fascinating looking at Letterboxd reviews of more recent times of Saw is this sort of obsession with Adam and Dr. Gordon as these, as essentially, like, everyone's shipping them, right?
They're distant lovers, quite literally, in that room. It's I love how it's just, even the Saw official, like, Twitter and Instagram pages have owned it as well. On, like, Valentine's Day, they posted, like, the bloody love heart drawn in the movie.
Oh.
With the two of them in the middle. So it's getting like owned by Lionsgate, which I find incredible.
Is it because Adam doesn't show him the photo at the beginning. Like, that's really
absolutely.
That's the best. Because, I mean, it's a wild meet cute when you think about it.
Absolutely.
But then when is the moment that they actually, well, one of them actually falls in love with the other, and it's when Adam's like, I'm not going to show him the photo.
Definitely. And I also think it's proven in the end when obviously, you know, spoilers, Dr. Gordon chops his foot off and he crawls over and they both finally are able to embrace each other from, you know, these opposite side of the room coming together. And he's like just whispering in his ear, like, I'm going to get help. I'm going to come back for you. Yeah,
I'm going to get help. I'll get help. He's got like the pale skin too. Like, I love the makeup he has as he's like bleeding out.
At least 100,000 of that 700,000 was spent on making Cary Elwes look like a
ghost.
That
was chalk. They had some chalk, like a chalkboard. They just grabbed that chalk and poured it over his face. They're like, yeah, you look like you're dying.
There's one, there's a Letterboxd member, Amaya, who is up there. I mean, people rewatch the crap out of Saw. Like, we have. We have the receipts. We know who you are, the people who have seen it more than 25 times. And Jay, you're not one of them, but Amaya is. And of many of her reviews, I think two of my favorites are, she writes, can't believe a dumb horror movie about two stupid men crawling on a dirty bathroom floor and yelling at each other is the best thing ever. And
it's true. She's so right.
Yeah. And then her other one, I think it's her most recent one. You could play the last 5 minutes of this movie anytime, anywhere, and as long as I'm within a 20-mile radius, I'm going to come bursting through your window screeching like a pterodactyl.
No, it's so fitting. It's such an intense ending. And I think the score is in testament to that as well, by Charlie Clouser. It's just like an enormous string percussion like coming in. That must have been where a lot of the budget went to, right?
Actually, the music is probably one of the most visceral memories I have of that scene where he gets up and the music like kicks in hard. And before we get your take on the poster, your five-star, whatever rating you might have for the poster, but James Wan had also gone on from here to have such a storied career still. Mm-hmm. I mean, Malignant was like the most recent big one, but Conjuring, oh my God, Insidious. Those are really fun movies.
An endless career. It's such like a bizarre career trajectory. He's like gone from these tiny indie horror films that he kept making for a couple more years after this, and then just got like swept up into the storm of these mainstream horror movies that are still really good. Like, you put them against the majority of horror movies that get power through Hollywood. The Conjuring and Insidious still are like miles above the rest. And then he got swept up into, you know, Aquaman, which I have my reservations for. I think it's a bit of fun.
There's an octopus playing bongos. I have no problem with Aquaman.
And there's Pitbull doing a cover of Toto's Africa. Like, what more can you want? What more can you want?
Okay, so where does the Saw poster rank? I mean, this is your number one choice. And let's dive into this poster, shall we?
So I don't love the poster. I think there's a lot of like unneeded texture on it. It could be a lot cleaner, but it does reflect the era. The early 2000s, the posters were very grungy and gritty and quite ugly. But I think it very simply explains what you're going to get yourself into with the film. The film's not particularly gory, but you're going to see a guy probably chop his foot off. So that's all you need to know. And there's the Saw jaggers at the top.
There is another alternate poster, which I just changed to. It's the black with the red text of Saw, and it's the woman wearing that helmet.
Yes.
Where she was trapped with. That's a really nice poster.
Who I have not seen another single Saw movie, but I understand that we see her again.
Oh.
Yeah, we see her. We see her a couple of times, and we also see the reverse bear trap a couple more times.
What is your favorite poster of all time?
My favorite poster of all time, I was thinking of this before we came on because I thought that might be thrown at me. It's definitely the lobster. I think you cannot go wrong with a bit of negative space, a bit of black and white photography. And it's just proven how iconic it is, because the majority of clients that we get in, one of their reference posters is almost always the lobster. And you can never capture something that iconic. And you don't want to copy it, obviously. Mm-hmm. But I think it's just genius.
It's going to be pretty freeing, too, to get clients at least that are, you know, open to some pretty high-tier design aesthetic.
Yeah, definitely.
To getting the crap out there, just putting whatever together.
No, it's true. Like, I'm blessed with being able to work for a company that we still work with a lot of indie films. and small directors that want some kind of iconic poster. And don't get me wrong, we have done like bigger projects that do require you to have an actor's face at a large size or a couple. And that's always a shame, but I do find myself quite lucky that we can revert to the more like iconic styles of design and make something that's genuinely like actual art at the end of the day, more than just a movie poster, something that people want to have hanged in their rooms.
Wow. We will get into a few more details about how posters happen and approvals and key stills versus illustration and all that kind of stuff. So many meaty questions. But first of all, rumor has it you designed the or a poster for Robert Eggers' The Lighthouse.
Yeah, you're completely right. I did. Not the official one, though. I do like the official one, but there's a little bit of a story behind the poster for The Lighthouse. And it is, I think, well, the start of my career in film and film poster design kind of started there. So a couple of years ago, before The Lighthouse had even been released, I was doing a bit of poster design just like for fun. I did an alternate like Hereditary poster and Suspiria and kind of trying to get my name out there, but nothing was clearly like working amazingly yet. But at this point I had an amazing interest in film and planned to go to Cannes Film Festival in 2019. Mm-hmm. And that was the film I was mainly going there for. I couldn't wait to see it. What we had was just this one still, no like other promotional images. And we went there on a mission, and me and some friends, we all queued for about 5 hours outside for the second ever screening.
And the Lighthouse?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And wow, like it was completely worth it. Like what a film. I'm sure we'll get into it, but I love it so much. But I came home from Cannes and instantly got straight on with making my own like alternate poster. And technically it was like the first one that came out, like the first alternate one. Before anyone else got onto it. And so I do that and I put it out there and it gets a bit of traction. And enough traction, in fact, to get a DM from A24, which is long gone. It's on an old Twitter account, but a DM from A24 being like, oh, can you send us your portfolio and your resume? And so that was like amazing. I was only like 19 or 20 at the time. And to get something like that, I was over the moon. And obviously nothing came from it at all. And understandably, I was like just a 20-year-old who didn't have much in his portfolio. So I just like accepted it, realized that they had moved on. And then the official poster drops a couple weeks later and it is extremely similar to mine. And I didn't want to toot my own horn at all on Twitter, but we had a lot of people being like, you've copied this design, everyone going nuts. Yeah, it was just like a whirlwind. Cause then I got like a load of freelance requests and some more jobs in. So it worked as promotion. I got what I wanted. Obviously, you know, I'll never get a tiny little bit of credit for the Lighthouse design, but working in the industry now, you do realize that inspiration comes from like a lot of different things. And it wasn't like the most original design in the world. I am all in all over it, but it's just a fun little story that got me into the game, really.
2019. This movie, I like couple this together in what I would call like air quote letterboxed movies. Mm-hmm. Like, and then let me see if I have my notes. I looked at the year. I mean, 2019 is the beginning.
What a year.
The pandemic. Parasite. What a freaking year.
Absolutely.
Portrait of a Lady on Fire, Parasite, The Lighthouse. Those three alone, let alone anything else.
I have so many five stars from that year. Like The Lighthouse, Uncut Gems, Parasite. I love Marriage Story. Mm-hmm. Also Portrait of a Lady on Fire. I think I have 4.5. Like it's like what a year for my first year of getting into film properly, like attending film festivals. Getting deep into poster design, like wow,
it's giant. Like, is this the greatest year of all time for film? 2019.
Honestly, it's gonna be hard to beat.
I think there's a couple of years in the 1970s that might have something to say.
I don't know. I think we're making it official. Letterboxd says 2019 is the greatest year of cinema ever.
Greatest year of cinema in Letterboxd's lifetime. How about that?
So the synopsis, I'm not sure if this is a Gemma synopsis or this is the official one. Two lighthouse keepers try to maintain their sanity while living on a remote and mysterious New England island in the 1890s.
I looked at that and I had no notes. So that is unchanged from the Letterboxd synopsis.
One of the rare perfect synopsises, according to Gemma.
We have to do some Jack's facts on this one because it is a, as Slim says, air quotes, Letterboxd movie. This one is a biggie, writes Jack. It's our fourth most popular horror film of all time.
Wow.
It is currently our 21st highest rated horror film. It remains the highest rated and most popular of Robert Eggers' filmography. 2019, it was number 6 in our year in review and the top rated horror movie of the year, as well as the 2010s in general. But Get Out has nudged above it. And it is, this strikes me as crazy, because I watched it, loved it, and went, I will never watch it again. It is the fifth highest rated obsessively rewatched film of 2020 on Letterboxd. Oh my God. So when everybody was in lockdown, this was in the top five of films people were rewatching that year. I mean, what a film to watch in lockdown, like one time, let alone multiple times.
It's definitely a lockdown movie.
It is definitely a pandemic film.
I think a lot of people did the same thing of just being like stuck in this enclosed environment with like one person probably just getting drunk. And that's the whole film, right?
Yeah. Right. So you have a list. You have one of your many lists as my parents reviewing films. And on The Lighthouse, your note is your dad said, I can see why you liked it.
Yes.
So tell us why you like it.
Oh, wow. Yeah, it's funny my dad said that. I struggled to sell it to them because how else do you explain it other than it's two people just going insane in a lighthouse over the course of 2 hours? I don't know. I just think it's, a lot of my love for it comes from the story I've just said about going to Cannes and seeing it in such a film-centric environment. But I think a lot of my love for it comes from Robert Pattinson's performance. Mm. I think he is absolutely spellbinding. And I think his career is like one of just something that's going to be marveled in years to come. I don't know what you guys think. I think he's just absolutely incredible from a career starting off in like the Twilight movies, which have grown to have a little bit of a cult following. However, I don't know, he's like dipped his toes into indie for a little bit with Good Time and The Lighthouse, and now he's back at the top doing Tenet and Batman. And this was definitely a stepping stone to get him there.
Yeah. There's always going to be that group of people like, oh, the guy from Twilight? that guy? But I mean, yeah, you're right. Some of his indie movies, I didn't love them, but I mean, he's going hard and like whatever project he chooses. I mean, his cheekbones in this movie are mind-blowing. My God.
Did anyone have cheekbones this good in the 1900s? I don't think so.
If you weren't eating that much, then yes, sure. I would totally have those cheekbones. That was my biggest feeling and thought about this. So I saw this at TIFF in 2019. It was in the midnight section, rolled along to the red carpet to have a chat with the Eggers brothers, and Robert was there on the red carpet, but there was no getting close to him because he did. It was really extraordinary that the Twilight fans were out, and it was just this weird cognitive dissonance of Twilight fans being out for The Lighthouse, right? But they weren't actually going to see the film. They had come to see him, and he walked onto the red carpet. He had about 30 seconds with one member of the media, and then he just strolled away and went straight over to the other side of the carpet where the fans were. And did his fan thing. And I remember then going, you're so graceful. You're so calm about this. You're not kind of avoiding it. You're just taking it for what it is, which is the fans of the films that enabled you to choose any project you like. And I also spoke to Daniel Radcliffe at that same TIFF, and it was a similar thing. He was there for some wacky movie where he gets guns strapped to his hands and Guns Akimbo has to live stream a game. Chatted to him about that. And again, you know, it's once you've done Harry Potter, your choices are endless. And I really love that these actors are going, yep, bring me the most bonkers script you've read lately, and I'll throw myself into it.
No, definitely. I love that, like, they have the feeling of, sure, we did these films in Twilight's case not like the best critically acclaimed. However, you've earned like all that money. Why not go nuts? Why not try something new and build up that like acting portfolio that will enable you to get like enormous roles in years to come?
This was finally a first time viewing for me. I had this, yeah. I had put it off for, I was about to say, I'd put it off for so many years, but it wasn't even that long ago that this had come out realistically. but it did hit that like nuclear hype level where I was like, oh, I got to let this cool down a bit before I finally see it. And mainly the only thing I had known, even from my own friend circles, like my friend Danny had taken his wife to see it. And I feel like that became like a famous story between the two where I'll never go see a movie like that ever again with you. Like, why did you pick this movie? This is the worst night of my life. I think he gave it 4 stars, but she had maybe the worst theatrical experience of her life seeing that movie. So I thought this movie was gorgeous. I thought it was funny. Some of my favorite scenes, obviously like that pose towards the end, the lights coming from Willem's eyes, that shot.
When they're naked.
Oh my God. That was awesome. Striking.
Gorgeous.
And then that bucket of poo that he brought to the water and tried to dump it. Oh my God.
There's a lot of poo humor in this movie.
There is a lot of poo humor. I audibly gasped. Once they showed the bucket, I was like, well, we're in for a real treat here. Something's about to happen with that bucket. And sure enough, it did.
My God. I also love the way that you can get deranged by so many things that actually aren't being personal to you, but you take it personally, like the seagull, for example.
Oh, definitely.
It's like,
oh
my God. Taking a perfectly innocent seabird, like so personally that it becomes...
What do you mean innocent? They're not innocent at all. Come on now. I'm from Devon, the southwest of England, and seagulls go at you. You go down to the beach with like any kind of food and they will be swarming around you. This film captured just like the horror of that bird. Horrible.
I learned recently that seagulls are in decline and it's all humans and climate change's fault. And I have changed my mind about seagulls. I have become that person who's like, nope, the beach is yours. You're 100% correct.
This is the 1890s. It was a different time back then, Gemma. Very different time.
I just, the thing I found most striking about my viewing at Toronto was how, and even for a midnight screening, how quiet the audience was. I was laughing like a drain. I was having the best time. I was sitting between two complete strangers. We had a great chat beforehand. We all sort of got the sense of humor inherent in this movie. Because I think there's a thing about Robert Eggers where he presents so seriously and the types of films he makes are, you know, based on ancient poems or ancient myths or the story of Hamlet. And so we must approach with complete seriousness. And it's like, he's also having a laugh. I had a long chat with his brother Max, who wrote this film with him. And the film is very much based on their relationship as brothers. And when you know that, when you sort of go in going, oh my God, these are siblings stuck in a house together. I found it really interesting the number of people who want to take it very seriously because I think maybe Robert Eggers doesn't do himself any favors because he's so intricately involved in the production design of the thing, you know, the specific brassware and kettles and pots and things that they had in there. Art directors, set decorators would bring him things and he'd go, no, not period enough, wrong. And they'd have to go away and bring something else back. Yes, you finally got it. Or the design of the lighthouse itself, which frankly, Robert Pattinson was right to want to live in that crystal penis tip because it is so beautiful. But I thought, well, I approach with a sense of humor and I think that's why I had such a good time. Esther Rosenfeld has possibly the most popular review of this film on Letterboxd, 17,000 likes so far. Idiots will call this a staggering retelling of the myth of Prometheus through the eyes of the American laborer, the fire of the gods becoming success under capitalism, an unattainable fiction that drives men to maddened violence in their pursuit. Geniuses will understand that this is a movie about getting drunk and almost kissing your homie and then getting even drunker and tenderly holding each other as you drift off to sleep.
It's absolutely true. I feel like this movie is the perfect epitome of a house party. where you're just like all trapped in this enclosed environment and you're all just going to get really drunk, and then it instantly just the mood switches and you're all just like sat down having a smoke, going deep into your life stories, and then it switches again and you're all doing shit sea shanties in the middle of the room.
17,000 likes. My God, what do you even do with yourself if you get that many likes on a review? What did you think of The Northman? Have you seen The Northman, Jay?
I still haven't seen The Northman, considering how much I like love The Witch and the Lighthouse. Mm-hmm. I just hadn't got there yet. I still want to, and I've heard from other people that it's essentially Robert Eggers taking the like 90 million or whatever that Universal gave him and just going all out, getting like authentic Viking costumes. We're going to go shoot on scene. He just uses every single coin that he's given.
Oh, yeah.
And goes completely nuts.
Yeah, to make yet another film about the futility of man.
Yes.
But think about the Northman, you know, the Northman poster, how everyone thinks it was a mistake that the title of the film was left off. And I'm like, do you, in the film industry, do you get that many posters printed without somebody noticing that the title is missing?
Well, it's funny you say that because I have a colleague who hopefully won't mind me mentioning this, but he knows someone like through like, you know, loads of people, like a friend for a friend for a friend. And he knows someone that was behind that whole mistake at Universal. And it was a mistake. It was not like a marketing gimmick that everyone seems to think it is, a careless mistake that that helped them essentially. Amazing marketing.
Yeah.
Like it went viral on Twitter and everything, but completely a mistake. But I don't know how those mistakes actually happen, because there's a software that we use called Adobe InDesign, which any designers listening will be groaning because we absolutely hate InDesign. But the app will let you know when an element of the design is missing, because the app works with like links from other softwares to get like the highest quality in your print. And it'll let you know, like it'll be flagged with a yellow exclamation point. So I have no idea how it happened, but
somebody didn't see the yellow exclamation point.
It's like Clippy from Microsoft. Jay, you left the logo off the file, Jay. Don't export, Jay.
Oh, Clippy. God, that's so fascinating. I mean, these kind of, it's like, it's such a massive industry, and it's just surprising to me. Like, there's this whole story about, you know, all the Barbie photos that have been released or leaked of Ryan and, you know, Maggie. They look incredible.
Yes.
And they were roller skating in neon on Venice Beach. How is it not possible to get photos of that? But
definitely.
People are saying, and I'm like, that's an advanced leak to raise the hype for the film. But there's people in the industry going, no, Warner Brothers aren't that clever. No, they just kind of hoped that people would stay away if they laid out their orange cones and said that it was a film shoot. It's like, that's not going to happen.
I honestly, because like sometimes with like the early stages of trying to get a poster done, and you ask for like on-set photography and behind the scenes, and sometimes they don't even have time for that, let alone trying to think of marketing schemes while shooting.
Wow.
Like, there's no way that like these are schemes that they've thought up on set, because no one has time for that.
So you've got a list. Film posters don't feel so good. It's a collection of film posters from 1975 right through to now, where there's a person's head and part of it is broken or cracked or shearing off into pieces. So clearly a kind of like design theme running through all of these posters. Jay, how does this happen?
Well, the themes, how do they happen?
Yeah, yeah. The similarities and the, are people like making letterbox lists of comp titles and going, I want that, but for this film.
No, it has to happen. Like, absolutely. I feel like, again, like no shade on any agencies, but I feel like there's a lot of people that get handed briefs where the client, or yeah, maybe it's like the client's fault, where they are so hellbent on wanting an exact thing, where at some point you do have to just listen to the client and be like, okay, well, you want this thing. There's really not much point in going like round and round trying to offer you something original and interesting when realistically what they're paying you for is something that they want. And I think that might be the product of that list of just so many people wanting a head crumbling apart. And it's happened so many times that like it might, clearly it's working somewhere along the line, right?
Well, it's like, remember when everything Everywhere All at Once came out, there was like the buzz and the somewhat of a trend popping up for posters after that as well. And then people were calling that out.
Yeah. And then Doctor Strange and then Bullet Train and then the, yeah.
Bob's Burgers, I think, maybe had one as well.
Yeah. Bob's Burgers. Definitely. And the new 3 years, what's it called? The new George
3,000 Years of Longing. Yeah. I think that also has one too.
That poster did like the exact same thing again of just literally everything everywhere. Like the film, makes sense with the poster it gave us. And yeah, that poster for Everything Everywhere is stunning. Yes.
And what have you worked on? I was looking up intermission films. They've worked on some good ones. Andrea Arnold's Cow is just exquisite.
That's one of mine.
You just like, it's called Cow. The cow is beautiful. I'm just putting the cow on the poster.
Yeah, basically. I mean, so with that, we had like such a wide selection of cow images. And Andrea Arnold's whole thing was like, we need to just show this cow for the beauty that it is. I don't know if you've seen.
It's about the modern life of a cow.
Essentially, and just follows a cow around with a film camera over the course of 7 years, and it's extremely difficult and a very like, real view of the farming industry with no particular stance. However, they didn't want to market it like that because realistically, who is going to want to see that? So they just wanted to see something like pretty, essentially, and what better way to show that than just a photo of the cow in quite a nice green field?
We should move on to perhaps the best poster we've discussed so far from 1997, John Woo, Face Off. 3.4 average, 480 fans. I feel like that's a little bit low for this nearly 3 hour action sensation. I have not read this, but it does look like a Gemma special, so I'll read it. 29 minutes into John Woo's first major Hollywood blockbuster, John Travolta's character, Sean Archer, is told the best way to get close to the conspirators of a domestic terrorist whom he has been after for years is to medically switch faces with him. He just says, yeah, okay. And the next minute, Travolta's anti-terrorism agent now has the face of the comatose psychopath, Castor Troy, played by Nicolas Cage. The fun begins.
The fun definitely begins. What a film. I had to throw in just like an abysmal movie in here. Oh my God.
I love Face Off. This is maybe the most unhinged sexual action movie of the 90s, I feel like. It's definitely just so off the rails. I love it. Well, do you remember the first time you saw it?
So I actually saw it for the first time early this year.
Oh. So,
it stayed under my radar for so long. Although I was aware of it, I just hadn't got quite around to it yet. But through lockdown and going into the film industry, you watch a lot of good movies. Like that's the point. Like you're watching these good movies to try and market. But in my like outside of work time, I tend to find myself going more towards the more like so bad they're good movies, just because they're so much fun. Like they're a blast. Like you sit there with your friends and you're like cheering at the screen like way more than you would at like any like kind of slow 3 hour artsy movie where like all I need is realistically like speedboats flying everywhere, John Travolta and Nicolas Cage hamming it up. Like, wow.
IndieWire recently did a 25 best movie performances of the 1990s piece, and they did not include Alessandro Nivola as Nicolas Cage's brother, Pollux,
which
I think is just doing damage to the 1990s film canon.
What is that voice he's doing in this movie? I can't.
Oh, really knows.
It makes me want to claw my eyes out every time I watch this movie. Whatever he's doing, I can't stand it.
Not feeling very coordinated lately, are you?
Shock treatment.
What's the matter with you? Did they operate? What was my medication?
I know, but I also wrote down in my notes that we need a major revisionist essay about the true MVP of Face Off.
Uh-oh.
And she is Joan Allen. I mean, she has to juggle two husbands. She has to sleep with both of them. She has to play convincingly that she really thinks that John Travolta, who was her husband, is now also her husband. Oh my God, she's incredible. Like, if she doesn't pull off her performance, I think the entire House of Cards falls. It doesn't matter.
You're absolutely right.
How hammy John and Nick are, it does not matter. If Joan Allen cannot hold that balance, it all falls apart.
No, you're completely right. How she manages to keep a straight face when John Travolta arrives home for the first time after the face swap. And he's just like pulling up in his car, slamming the door, like, oh God. Yeah. It's just being weird to his daughter. Like, oh my God. So weird. Yeah.
But how she manages to keep a straight face when John Travolta does the thing with the hand down the face. Like, oh.
The hand thing.
What do you mean? It's the most accurate portrayal of romance the 90s has ever seen.
And parenthood. Yeah. Do that hand face thing to anyone you love in your life.
I saw in some Letterboxd reviews, it's actually got an official title. It's The Hand Waterfall.
Oh my God. It is rough. I have seen this several times and I come back to what you had said, Jay, about loving the movies that are kind of bad, but having an amazing experience doing so. So Hard Target is another movie that I put in there from John Woo, where I have ratings that I've added to my Letterbox, but that aren't related to a log. So they're kind of like before Letterbox memories. I call them BLB, before Letterbox.
Nice. Yeah.
And I had a 1-star for Hard Target and I rewatched it. I got the 4K and I was like, what was I thinking? This is so much fun. I gave it 4.5 stars and it kind of like opened up my eyes again to movies that I would have considered like, oh, that movie is bad, but it's still good. They're fun.
Absolutely. It's like, I feel like, at least a while ago, maybe like 4 or 5 years ago when I was starting to use Letterboxd, you have like this bit of pressure where you're like, oh, even if I really enjoyed a movie, technically I can't give this a high rating because it's bad. Like, like you can't say that Face Off is like a really great piece of cinema. But then like the older you get and you just start realizing like, wait, I'm rating movies based on how I enjoyed them. And did I find this like fun? And a boy I did. Yeah. What a time I had.
Yes, yes.
So does this one push over the cliff of your histogram?
Honestly, a couple more watches and it's definitely there. Couple more times.
One of the things too that I thought about while on this recent watch, you know, your megastars, John Travolta and Nicolas Cage, and then you hear that John Woo is like making another, you know, US movie. If I were them at that point, I would probably have done anything to be in his movies. Cause I watched Hard Boiled for the first time this year. Mm. And if I'm like a mainstream actor, you're like, put me in that movie. I want to be in whatever he does next. And he does Hard Target. He does Face Off. Like he gets wild in these things.
Yeah. I need to watch more of his movies. Definitely. I just need to go into like back catalogs of like schlocky 80s and 90s action movies. There's so many fun ones. One of my favorite other ones in that like pocket of cinema is Death Wish 3, the Charles Bronson movies. Like just so much fun. Like this, because at the time of Death Wish 3, Charles Bronson was probably like late 60s, early 70s. And just like the dystopian environment it creates, that's just New York and everyone's shooting everyone. I love terrible movies. There is nothing more enjoyable for a film than for it to be a complete catastrophic failure. Yeah. That is like so much fun.
What did you think of Face Off, Gemma?
I mean, I saw this when it first came out in cinemas. 1997. Wow, that was, I remember that was a year for cinema, wasn't it? And we were screaming, absolutely screaming. I mean, what else was there to do? It's so weird. I remember this, it being so weird to me though, watching John Travolta like this, because I think he'd sort of done Grease, which, you know, was very formative in my early years. And then he'd done some weird I'm an Angel called Michael movies.
Oh, yeah.
Boy in the Bubble stuff. I don't know. All I remember is just screaming. A screamingly good time.
I was going to ask like how well this played in front of a cinema audience, because I've watched this like twice with friends, but both in like just living rooms with TVs. So I need to find a screening of this somewhere.
Yeah, it was insane, but it was also what we were getting a lot of at the time. So it was like just another Friday night at the cinema, another American action flick, but there was something different about it. And I didn't really understand the John Woo-ness of it all back then, but watching it this time, it totally came through. I mean, the doves, can we talk about the doves?
That and Hard Target, when I first watched those movies, I was like, what is this? This is a weird movie. And then you open up like some of his filmography, you're like, oh, okay. And Mission Impossible 2 also, that was probably maybe his biggest one.
I just don't think action movies nowadays are nearly as fun. Like, obviously you've got your like Mission Impossible has finally got it right with like Fallout, and I think it's going to carry over onto the next ones. And then there's the John Wick movies, which are always fun. But like, take The Gray Man, for example, that definitely needed something like hammy performances, ridiculous set pieces. Like, The Gray Man failed, well, I guess, critically failed because it was just nowhere near as fun as it should have been. Mm-hmm. And Face Off, you know, some people think it's a great time, some people think it's complete nonsense, but at least you can admit that it's just a blast.
And it rests on the baddies, right? I mean, the 90s were Dennis Hopper and Speed, you know, and it's Nicolas Cage and Face Off. It's, we do in Marvel movies get wacky baddies, and you know, in Bond movies you get Javier Bardem acting his tits off, but they're incredible. But I just think in the action films we do get, the baddies just, Chris Evans and a porn stash isn't it?
Yeah, it just wasn't enough. It really wasn't. Honestly, I kind of wish they just like had Nicolas Cage and John Travolta be there in those roles in The Gray Man. Just doing like the exact lines.
Oh my God, that would be insane. Holy cow.
It would.
Can you believe that Arnold Schwarzenegger and Sylvester Stallone were originally being eyed for Face Off?
Wow. I mean, I still want to see it.
Yeah.
can't say I don't want to see it, but.
But I find that really fascinating. Like all of that casting stuff. What's interesting about reading Letterboxd reviews for your fourth favorite, When Harry Met Sally, is how many people have opinions about Billy Crystal and whether he should have been Harry. And like, it's like 5 stars, except Billy Crystal is the tenor of so many Letterboxd reviews of When Harry Met Sally. And I'm keen to discuss that as we move into Rob Reiner's 1989 absolute god-tier rom-com, written by the great Nora Ephron, based on their friendship. Rob Reiner and Nora Ephron's friendship. It's got a 4.0 average. It's got many, many, many fans. And it asks the timeless question, can men and women be friends after sex? And that single question fuels a decade-long dance between Harry and Sally in this famous blueprint for the rom-com formula, starring our beloved Meg Ryan and nobody's favorite, Billy Crystal. What is that about?
Oh, he's absolutely my favorite. He is so good in this movie. I think it just like, I think it kind of makes it really that he's not like a chiseled, perfect rom-com star, right?
He's not Matthew McConaughey, eh? He's not.
Exactly.
And he's not sort of as soft as Tom Hanks. It works because he is who he is.
Yeah, it works perfectly. And like, Harry's meant to be a bit of an asshole, right? He's not the nicest guy in the world. If he was the nicest guy in the world, then Sally would have fallen for him like instantly. He's meant to have this just like bizarre thing to him. And I mean, that comes through in like the conversation, because I think the conversation is the absolute star of this movie. Like, the script is impeccable. Just real life conversation. It's just genius. It's amazing.
I need more romantic movies with the everyman in the lead role. Get these McConaughey's out of here. Get his six-pack abs out of here. Get me in the role, you know?
Did you watch that one with J-Lo and what's his name? Owen Wilson?
Oh yeah, I saw that.
No. That's your everyman rom-com, Slim. You need to go and get the wife and settle down and watch Owen Wilson, a humble Brooklyn school teacher, get in with J-Lo, an absolute superstar.
Really?
It wasn't. Not the worst. It wasn't
not the worst.
Yeah. J-Lo back at what she does best. Like, J-Lo had a little spell with Hustlers where, like, you know, a Golden Globe nomination came through. Unfortunately, Academy Awards didn't pull through, but she saw it, she took the note, and went back to doing trash, as she should.
I also love the idea of like me searching for reviews and I see Gemma's and it just says not the worst exclamation point. And then I'm like, well, okay, maybe I will watch this.
I forgot writing that, but yeah, it's true. So what you say about the conversations, absolutely, that comes through in all of the Letterboxd reviews. And I think it works so well because it is, I didn't rewatch When Harry Met Sally for this conversation. What I did do was go through and look up like oral histories of the film. Because I wanted to understand more about the friendship between Nora Ephron and Rob Reiner. And he had his heart broken and was coming out of heartbreak into making this film and just oversharing, just totally talking too much, completely oversharing about what was going on for him. And she put all of that into Harry as like, here's the guy who just is like, you don't always have to say what you think. Like there are inside thoughts and there are outside thoughts. And Harry's just like, blah, 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 blah. And she would get on the phone and interview Rob and write down all the notes and just basically put that into the script. And I love that, that he's directing, and he and Billy Crystal were really good besties. So he's directing his bestie as himself. And then towards the end of shooting the film, Rob Reiner met the love of his life. And so they're coming out, so as they're coming out at the end of it, there's a, like this insane kind of air of romance around the set that just fuels the last few bits and pieces of the, I love it.
No, it's such a nice fact.
Love is real. I'll read Amanda's review. I think we might've read it before, but it's one of my favorites. My dad muted the fake orgasm scene, but then my mom grabbed the remote and turned the volume back on. What an icon. I loved When Harry Met Sally. I always think back when I was growing up, my parents loved Steve Martin, Robin Williams, and Billy Crystal. Like those guys were literally untouchable. Anything they could say on television, they were howling. So these actors, looking back and watching some of these movies for the first time ever, I just have like a different appreciation because at that time, like they were perfect, you know, the perfect comedians. They could do no wrong of that time frame. So when like I hear people talk about Steve Martin, I always think back to that era. And like other younger actors have had that too, that I always reference, like Jim Carrey. Like Jim Carrey had a stretch of like 6 or 7 movies where he was like the biggest shit ever in movies, and there was nobody close. So it's just a lot of fun to go back and watch some of those movies from those eras or those actors.
It's amazing. And to be fair, there are Billy Crystal defenders on Letterboxd. Sophie writes, the fact that they somehow made Billy Crystal sexy in When Harry Met Sally, that's the magic of cinema.
It's true. Defense?
No,
it doesn't sound like a defense.
It doesn't sound like a defense.
Backhanded compliment on Billy.
I think it's absolutely true, though. Like it's definitely through like the costuming as well. Just like now we're like
white
late
sweater.
August. We're going into like autumn now. It's time to get out the When Harry Met Sally fits. We're getting out the knitwear, the long coats, stuff that makes people like Billy Crystal look like a model.
Oh my God, when they're looking at the apartment and they're both just in their jeans and their sweaters against that huge New York loft window, it's just iconic. Olivia Craighead writes, and I think this is also potentially not a defense, it's a negging. Do you think this movie would be as good if Billy Crystal was 6 foot? I think even if he were 5'10", the energy would be all off.
You know
off.
What? I'm looking at Billy Crystal's white sweater from that still. It's almost identical to the one that Chris Evans wears in Knives Out.
Definitely.
Oh, yeah.
Blowing my mind right now. My God.
I thought you were going to say, I'm looking at Billy Crystal in that sweater and I'm in love.
That could be. It feels weird, but maybe it could be true.
It does have that effect.
Usually at the end of the episode, we'll go back, look at the profile of our guest to see what else they've been watching. There's a note in here. How was your most recent rewatch of Hannah Montana the Musical?
Again, like Face Off, that's a film I've seen twice this year. It's just like with me and my housemates, when we bring out a terrible movie and we'll sit around and watch it, it's just a blast.
I mean, once makes sense, but twice, like who was it in the flat who went, let's watch Hannah Montana the Musical?
Fire it up.
I'm pretty sure it was me again.
And what did you get out of it on a second viewing?
Well, I'll tell you what we got out of it. We got to see the Tyra Banks fight again. Because Hannah Montana gets into a fight with Tyra Banks over some shoes. We get character actress Margot Martindale playing her grandma. Oh, we get, yes. I know, we get a Taylor Swift cameo, which is so bizarre. It's just endless, endless joy and endless things to talk about.
You are selling me so much on Hannah Montana the Musical right now, which has been
poster,
on my watch list
my
for a while. I mean, there's some floating heads.
Seriously.
Floating heads on beaches. But it's been on my watch list for quite a while, but specifically ever since we did a list, thanks to Jack's Facts, we looked at, we wanted to know that in the 10 years that Letterboxd had been alive this time last year, which films had risen up the ratings histogram the most. Not that they've gone from 1 star to 5 stars, but they've gone from maybe 1 star to 3 stars, you know, as in over time, which films have been kind of re-looked at and re-appreciated. And I am pleased to say that Hannah Montana is one of those films. In fact, of the 50 that we identified, it's the 5th out of 50 in terms of its biggest ratings increase over time. So that's you're not alone in your appreciation of Hannah Montana, the musical.
The Hannah Montana stats, Renaissance.
Justice for Hannah Montana.
So
speaking
true.
Of stats, the Your Own Records show us that the film you have watched the most. Do you know what it is?
So it could be, I've logged a lot of things. It could be The Social Network.
It is The Social Network.
Wow.
What keeps you coming back?
I think it's, so here's the thing, I was going to choose The Social Network, but it fell off for like Face Off instead. But I just think The Social Network has the best pacing like ever in a movie. I think it breezes by like the 2 hour runtime. I like, you can just put it on and before you know it, you're already at the fuck you flip flop scene. And the film is breezed by. I just think it just flies by so perfectly.
In terms of movie posters, it's got the classic half face. That is a classic, isn't it?
My God, that one had a theme for a bit too. Mm-hmm. The posters that the movies that had come out after that, I feel like I saw that in many movies.
Oh, definitely. There's a list out there, I think, with a lot of half faces. There's the Bohemian Rhapsody poster that's on Letterboxd too. Another half face. It's just every designer's got to have their half face moment.
Yeah.
And I hope that comes to me soon.
Crazy.
Last question for you, Jay.
Yes.
When our new poster feature comes in, what is the first poster you're going to change up on your Letterboxd?
Personally, I have to change the cow poster. Because currently my cow poster isn't the cow poster. So I got to change it to my own one. I've got to show off a bit, right?
Jay Bennett was our guest today. His posters can be seen in all good cinemas and on Letterboxd. Who knows? Maybe one day very soon you will select his poster as your favorite when our new patron poster selector feature drops next month. But you do need to be a patron member to get that feature. So by all means, if you have the means, head to our website or the app to upgrade right now.
We'd love that for you and for us. Thanks to our crew, Jack for the facts, Brian Formo for booking and looking after our guest, Sophie Shin for the episode transcript, and to Monica for the theme music. Be sure to listen to Weekend Watchlist, our other weekly podcast, where Slim, Mitchell and Mia explore the latest releases in cinemas and on streaming. It's out every Thursday. You can always drop us a line at podcast@letterboxd.com. Have we got any mail this week, Slim?
Now we're recording early this week, so we didn't give anyone an opportunity to send us a letter. So that's on us. That's on us, not you, dear listener.
I'll send you a letter, Slim. Also, think about leaving a nice review or rating on all good podcast platforms. That's how we keep this show going. The Letterboxd Show is a Tape Deck production. No more drugs for that man.
If I had a steak, oh boy, a bloody steak. If I had a steak, I would fuck it.
This is a Tape Deck Podcast.